My name is Roniel Tesler. I am 32 years old. Today's date is June 28th?
No, 27th. Tomorrow.
Today is June 27th, 2019, almost World Pride. And I am speaking with
Harold Kuden.
And we are recording this interview in New York City. And this is part two of our interview. Harold, go ahead.
Right. Okay, I wanted to talk about the American Psychological Association because that was a very important step in helping to spread the word about gay not being mental illness, or being gay, I should say. After the American Psychiatric Association passed their resolution, which they then had to go into an open vote of membership to declassify homosexuality. American Psychological Association had not done anything yet. And so we had at that point a grassroots organization. It was called the Association of Gay Psychologists, and it was national. I and two others from California were kind of the founders of it, and that was Steve Morin was sort of my counterpart in San Francisco. And what we did was basically deal with the American Psychological Association. At that point, I had had some mentors who were involved in radical health movement, and two of the women involved in that were non-gay women, but they supported it, and we had a resolution pending in the American Psychological Association Council of Representatives. And there was to be a vote on whether being gay is a mental illness or not, or homosexuality. And it went to a vote. I was the first openly gay psychologist to ever appear before a council of representatives, which were members from all the divisions. And what was interesting is that these two women spoke in favor of the resolution. I almost didn't have to speak because people got up who were against the resolution, and their rationale was, well, you can't, maybe yes, this should happen, but not for school teachers, for anyone connected with children. And they went on and made themselves so ridiculous that the people who were kind of in the middle and didn't want to come out on that issue, I mean, coming out in favor of it, were sort of forced, because if they didn't vote for the resolution, they would appear like these other people who really came across as incredibly stupid and prejudiced. And so what happened was that the resolution got passed, and APA decided they needed to start having some study of gay psychology. And they developed a task force. I was appointed the first chair. But usually in APA, whomever is the chair becomes the chair for the life of the committee. Since we had a network going, we developed our first meeting, and one of our first moves was to make it a rotating chair, that everybody should have a stance depending on what their expertise was in research, etc. And though APA protested, we said we would handle it, and we did. And the task force went on for about 5-6 years studying gay and lesbian psychologists. The reason I'm bringing it up is because it was the first time a professional organization was supporting gay and lesbian issues. And because there were committees in the American Sociology Association, National Association of Social Workers. One beginning group was the gay medical students. And what it did was lend support to the development of these becoming integral parts of these professional organizations. And they became very effective committees. And for me, it's important because not only did they do something in relationship to their own profession, it was developing a network throughout the United States of health professionals, however you want to define that, were beginning to connect with each other. And from that, we also developed an organization. There were six or eight of us. We created an organization, the National Gay and Lesbian Health Education Foundation. And we also put in our money to hire a lawyer to get us a 501(c), which other organizations could use, so that they could obviously become more independent financially. And we put on conferences, we put on a number of health conferences, then we put on an international health conference. Now this is all prior to AIDS. And the network was being established because more and more health professionals got together, so that when AIDS hit, there was already a network of health professionals throughout the country. And so then when it went from GRID to AIDS, and then we used our organization to a developing organization of people who were diagnosed as having AIDS, which eventually became the PWA, People with AIDS, et cetera, et cetera. The point I'm bringing up is that things built on other. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not this all of a sudden creation out of nowhere. And part of the importance for me of that is that one of the reasons why AIDS has, LGBT rights, I think, have moved so fast, more than any other oppressed minority, has to do with the fact that AIDS brought a lot of white gay men out of the closet, and many were already connected in the establishment, already had been part of another network, and they helped thrust basically the AIDS movement into the national limelight. And I say that because I think to minimize the importance of prior organizing, they stress that like nothing happened until that group got involved. And that happened both here as well as in San Francisco. And where we left off in our last talk, given the fact I had been involved politically, you know, within gay politics and all that, the second that AIDS sort of appeared, my fear was that it would be used by homophobes to really start squelching, and it would be used politically. So that was why I got two other people, who one of whom had never been involved in gay politics but was an immunologist. So I felt it was important. So we developed the AIDS network, which would be trying to get the AIDS organizations and groups within organizations, like the Gay Synagogue had a committee on AIDS, getting them to start coming together because they were fighting each other. It was that usual, I want my piece of the pie.
How are they fighting? What did
they weren't communicating.
Why?
They wanted to be their own sort of they wanted to have a priority. They weren't used to communicating with each other. I mean, there was no overall organization. So,
was it ego?
Yeah, it was ego, and also remember, GMHC got started with basically white males who had never been involved in the community. Their involvement was Pines, it was the A group, it was a very important group. I mean, it got to the extreme where, for example, when they did their big fundraiser at the circus for GMHC at Madison Square Garden, the president was still not out of the closet. You know, so that discrepancy was unfortunately, I think, one of the things that led to a lot of people not supporting it. But when this organization, for example, GMHC, was beginning to get started, they used our organization's fundraising abilities and 501(c) to, we sponsored, in a sense, their first fundraiser, which I must say, for me, was a very important moment, because I remember being at the fundraiser. It was a dance called Showers. And it was the first time that I could look around at a gay gathering and see men, women, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, whites, young, old. It was the first true cross-section of our community. And so I knew something good was coming from that. And then they started a national meetings, and we used our organization to get PWAs to that meeting. So, I mean, the only reason I'm going into the detail is, again, that idea that things don't happen by spontaneous, you know, explosion. There's a network. Because in the first couple of years of all the AIDS work, there are people talking to each other who had been before, and then they were able to bring more of their colleagues into the movement. And as I said, the AIDS Network, we met every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. In the first couple of weeks, no one showed up. And so all of the donuts and coffee went to waste. And then the first person who showed was from the AIDS committee, and I think it was a committee of three from the gay synagogue. And then after, I would say, 4 or 5 months of meeting, then GMHC started to send people. And that was a very pivotal point. Because one of the things we were doing was, first of all, getting the Times to start talking about AIDS. Because quite frankly, for many of us, it felt like it was being in the Warsaw Ghetto. Because people were dying all around us, but in the outer world, everything seemed to be fine and no one even heard about it. So we had meetings and got two of our members, Ginny Apuso and Roger Enlow, who was the immunologist, to go talk with the Times. And that was so they'd start doing some printing. And from that we developed a group that then started negotiating with the mayor's office, so that we then started to meet with a representative from the mayor, and then got a meeting between AIDS officials in the city and people from our committee. And from that, they appointed, the health department appointed an office on gay and lesbian health. So, I mean, all these things kept building. And from our weekly meetings, or monthly meetings, we had the commissioner of mental health who would come, and she recognized that there was no gay, well, no, at that point, gay and lesbian input. And so with her, we created the first gay and lesbian health committee within the Department of Mental Health. And I was the first chair of that. And that went on for a couple of years, and that still is ongoing.
That's this a city program?
A city. It's a city program, yeah. It's in a, well, it's an official committee within the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it still meets regularly at the community center. And I somehow, I think we did talk about the fact that after 3 or 4 years, we felt we had accomplished what we needed to accomplish, because by this point, all the AIDS organizations were talking with each other, the city was meeting regularly, and we had now brought the federal government in, so that all the connections were being made.
Mm-hmm. What year is that, that you feel like finally all the connections are being made?
Around 84, 85, some around there. And then, I'm pretty sure we did talk about this, at one of the meetings, later on, after it had disbanded, I was at a cocktail party gathering, and Larry Kramer was there, and he had talked about why we need to, how should I put it? We needed to bring back the AIDS network because it had been so effective. And I said, the AIDS network accomplished what it needed to accomplish. And I said, at this point in time, what we need to do is to access the grassroots, people who are not involved in organizations, but who were energized to do something around AIDS. And I said, it's an outside force in the same way we've always been an outside force forcing the establishment. Well, that's been done. We need another kind of outside force. And I said, look, there are only two people at this point who have name recognition, Ginny Appuso and you. And I said, I was working with Jenny on another project dealing with the city and all the leaders of gay organizations, because by this point we had probably 90 to 100. And we were doing a project, and she was busy because at that time she was a deputy commissioner in the state government. And I said, you're the only person who has name recognition. And I said, what we need to do is tap this group. And I said, let's get out a circular, bars and everywhere, and let's get it going. And you'll be at the meeting, and because you have the name recognition, and start. And that's what happened, and that's how ACT UP got started, which, as you know, was that outside force that was necessary, because people who were involved in organizations couldn't protest in the same way as the outside group could. Again, another development of things happening around and before leading to this. And so we're probably now, I think, 85, 86, and my involvement of then, Jenny and I were to go to Amsterdam, that's right, for the International Lesbian and Gay Association, to talk about gay and, well, to talk about gay and lesbian issues from an international perspective. This at the time was an organization of about 30 organizations, mostly Western Europe, but there were a few from Mexico and other countries. And Jenny was supposed to be a speaker at the conference. And something happened, she couldn't make it, and so I still went and I spoke in her place. And as I was thinking about what was going on, I was thinking, this is an international organization. What makes sense is it should be an NGO in the United Nations. And so I spoke to that point, which was the first time anyone had brought it up. And after I spoke, the president, it was Secretary General, they only had one, it was a male. That got changed to being co-male, female. Anyway, he came up afterwards and he said he thought that was a good idea and for me to pursue it, since I lived in New York, United Nations being here. So I said, good, I would. And so what I did was start the inroads of, I knew some people who were involved in the United Nations as volunteers. Anyway, I got the information. So the following year, which maybe that was 85, there is a meeting in Norway. And I presented the information that I had gathered, what needed to be done, which organization would be the conduit through the NGO. And I got approval to start doing what I could do. So I worked for, which meant actually attending meetings of another group, but it was connected with this particular body of the United Nations, and made the connections, got information, found out that in the NGO office was a in the closet lesbian. So anyway, what happened eventually was that in 93, we got NGO status.
So it took like seven years? If you said it was 85,
yeah.
And then...
Oh, yeah.
It took a long time.
Oh, yeah. It was, because it meant getting all the paperwork done, getting all the accreditation done. It meant talking to all of the delegates who composed the committee, which meant a lot of people had to talk with their representatives from their own countries. I mean, it was not a... From zero to that took a lot of work on a lot of people's part. And in the meantime, we got the community center to become a member of ILGA. It was the first organization. Unfortunately...
What is ILGA?
Oh, the International Lesbian and Gay Association.
Okay.
This is the international...
The one that you spoke... Okay.
Yeah. And unfortunately, what happened, and this all culminated in the 1994 Gay Pride, because what ILGA decided to do, at this point, I was the male representative of North America for ILGA. There's always a meet. At this point, everything was male-female. And so I was the male representative. And I got the community center to be a member of ILGA. And unfortunately, what happened was that NAMBLA, the North American Boy Love Association, had been at the very first ILGA meeting back, I guess it would have been in the late 70s. And at that point, when they formed, anyone who attended was a member. Okay. Now, they would not have been allowed in years later. But at this point, they got in. Well, what happened was that an international protest developed because there was an organization in the United States which was, I don't remember the exact name, but it was like Gay Watch, and looking like a gay organization. They wrote to ILGA after we got NGO status. They wrote to the office asking for a list of all the member organizations. And it was a long list, predominantly England, France, especially Holland. The Dutch are incredibly supportive of issues like this. And listed was also NAMBLA, which then Jesse Helms, the senator, published in the paper, "The United Nations supports pedophilia." Well, you can imagine the furor that went up, and it was traced to this NAMBLA being part of ILGA. So ILGA got suspended. And that was in 94. And what was ironic is that I was involved with the parade, and since ILGA had made the decision to have their annual conference in New York City, to make the parade an international one. So this World Pride today is not the first one, because we had an international contingent and we marched purposely. The gay parade marched by the United Nations. You know, another one of those first time. So anyways, ILGA got suspended or kicked off, and it was a process that took, oh, God knows how many meetings and votes and so on, and it took about 10 years for ILGA to get back.
So after all the work you did, and it was accepted as an NGO in 94, it was kicked off and took another 10 years to go back on.
And only got on because of gay sensibilities, you know, gay rights and all that had moved, and because they had a meeting in Geneva in which a number of the representatives were very, very strong about these issues. I was at one of the United Nations meetings, because there was the female ILGA representative. When we had the United Nations meeting, technically the Holy See does not have a voting member, but the member went around to all of the panel, etc. I mean, you could see the influence. And so after couple of times we lost, but eventually we got in, and now gay and lesbian organizations are established.
I want to pause for a second. We have 16 minutes left. I know, right? I want to pause though, and if it's okay, I'm interested in your personal life during this time. So I know about Joe,
right
in Chicago. And I know that you go to college and you come to New York, and you know, after all the people say that you'll never graduate and all of that against you, I want to hear a little bit about your, I don't know whether it's your, whatever you want to share, your friend circle, your romantic relationships, your day-to-day, because these are big political processes that you're a part of in creating. But I'm also interested in hearing like some of the other parts of your life.
Well, I met my late partner in 81. My first time ever having a share at Fire Island. And he and I were together almost 10 years. He was diagnosed as having given an AIDS diagnosis in 87, which was when I was diagnosed as being HIV positive. And he unfortunately was a man who had a difficult time with the idea of growing old. And he eventually died in 1990. He had only really been sick for a couple of years. And it was going to be, he self-delivered. I helped him do it. Because I'd always promised him he wouldn't always die at home, and I would be there, and that I would always have what was necessary if he wanted. But he actually waited, interestingly, until the hospice program had said it's imminent.
What was his name?
Jim Black.
Jim.
Yeah. And so he died in 1990, and then it was 7 years before I met anyone else, and I had really an affair with a man from Germany who lived in Germany, and it was sort of, we'd see each other every couple of months. And it was in 2001 that a literally non-gay friend of mine who I had known since college, through a connection she had, she lived in Florida, she had a friend who lived in Cleveland, and she wrote me about this friend in Cleveland who also was not gay, but he had a gay friend, and all she said was he was Black, he was about somewhere in his 50s, he had a relationship of 16 years, and the man died of AIDS. That's all I knew. She said, "Are you interested?" Felt like here was something arranged, and so I said yes, and we started corresponding, and we corresponded for months, and then a month or two, and then started talking on the phone, and then I went to Cleveland on a trip to see him, and basically a year and a half later, he quit his job there. He was associate dean at a university, had been chair of the art department, and moved to New York, and we lived together in my old apartment, which was too small for the two of us, and then we bought the brownstone, it's a co-op brownstone. We bought our apartment and have been together now, it's 18 years.
Yeah. Did you find that you had a lot of shared experiences with his childhood or growing up in Cleveland? And
well, he was from Detroit, and being Black, he knew what it was like to be part of an oppressed minority. And so we connected on a lot of those lines, but he was the first peer I really ever had in a relationship.
What do you mean by peer?
Intellectually, willingness to explore the world, openness to constantly growing, peer also in terms of profession.
Is he also a psychologist?
No, he's an art historian.
Oh, right, you said he was a dean. That's right, right, yeah.
Yeah. And what we connected, and it wasn't until we went to a 50th anniversary of the department that he had been in as an undergraduate, doesn't exist anymore. But it was a very interesting new kind of department. And when I was there listening to some of the people talk, at this point were in their 80s and 90s, I realized they were all from the University of Chicago. And basically, his background was very similar to mine.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a very total approach to a person. In my field, it was what attracted me to this department is that you studied individuals as psychological, physical beings in a social environment. All of that had to be, which is why most psychologists and I don't talk, because they have a much more narrow focus. And John came from that, even though it was art history, he saw the world very similarly. Mm-hmm. And we were able to talk about many, many issues, because the thing we both got from our university was how to think. And that's, there are a lot of educated people who can recite facts and figures, but thinking is another quality that unfortunately isn't taught very much. Mm-hmm.
In the years before you met Jim, who was your second?
Well, there were other boyfriends.
Sure.
But Jim was the important relationship.
Could you feel the shift after Stonewall and after, like, I guess, you know, there's almost like this, is it wrong to think that there was like a burgeoning Eden between Stonewall and AIDS, where finally gay men and women were starting to speak up for their rights before this crisis began?
Yes, happening.
What did it feel? Could you feel the difference in the air? Was that kind of instantaneous?
Yes.
In terms of before and after Stonewall? What was life like in the feelings of it then?
Okay, where I felt the freedom and I felt the, how can I put it? Yeah, where I felt that kind of freedom was in the professional organizations, mm-hmm. our meetings. I used to refer to them as our battery recharging meetings, where we'd have our meetings when a representative from various professions getting together. And then there was another very important organization, the Gay Academic Union, which existed. This would have been in the late 70s. And I remember going to one of the conferences that they did, and it was at Columbia University, and I remember coming out of the conference where I had been as a gay man cruising, as a professional leading workshops, as a participant in workshops. There were lesbians and gay men there. It was a day of just 100% being myself. And I remember as I walked out, and I remember the vision, I'm at the top of the steps, leaving the building, looking at Columbia, and realizing for the first time in my life, I felt I was a whole person with all aspects of me. I had been to psychological conferences, I had been to gay conferences, I had been to gay bathhouses, etc., but never had I had that sense of all of me was there. And I remember making a resolution to myself that at the time I was in my 40s, and or late 30s. Anyway, I remember saying, my God, it took me this many years to have this moment. I vowed at that moment that I would dedicate my life so my brothers and sisters could feel that earlier. Not have to wait that long. And that was a very important moment for me. And I would say, getting back to your question, Ronnie, it was happening, but it was happening within confines, the professional or the academic or this. But after Stonewall, it was everyone who was experiencing. And that I think is the shift, that I didn't have to have that feeling of isolation. And I mean, actually, when you mentioned the gay psychologist carrying the sign, if I remember correctly, the friend of mine who was carrying the other end was not a psychologist. Because there were not, I was one of the first gay psychologists to be public, you know, at a time when it was considered, you know, a death knell if you were to do that.
So, because it's 50 years tomorrow, I guess, is the 28th, is the riot?
26th.
The 26th was the riot.
Was the original date.
So yesterday. How do you hope that the brothers and sisters that you tried to make it easier for them to feel that wholeness at an earlier age, how do you hope that it progresses in the next 50 years? Because you've seen it from nothing to what it is now.
Yes.
You've seen it from then to Bank of America having compromised sides.
I know.
So.
I think there are two issues. I think, number one, it's getting everybody to start seeing, having models, whether it be from Pose, or Queer as Folk, all of these things. The fact that Mayor Pete is up there, I think that's one thing that's happening. So there are models being shown. But I think another point, which is, we've had this discussion with a number of people about the identity politics. I think we had to have identity politics to get our strength together, to get our feet on the ground. But my feeling was, at a certain point, we needed to also be in organizations around the country as openly gay, meaning in the health movement, in the climate change movement, et cetera. I mean, it's that we had to be there as openly gay, but supporting that issue. And I think that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's, I think the best, given the fact we're talking in the SAGE office, I think it's important to recognize that a number of years ago, SAGE's main impact was in creating a body to deal with LGBT elders. At a certain point in time at the national, when we used to have national conferences, it was a big step to have representatives from social work, from, there wasn't at the time Black Lives Matter, but the equivalent organization. So you had the CEOs and executive directors at the gay conference, the SAGE conference. Now these are parts of, you know, it's no longer we're the outsider. I think that's the way it has to be moving.
More integration, like further and further into all the other.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we have 2 minutes. And we could do a part three if you wanted to, but I just, is there any last thing you wanted to say about how you would like to be remembered?
As one of the people who helped make a change in the world. I mean, gay psychology is where it is because of what I helped to contribute. And the same with the gay movement. I mean, there are many of us who are not named recognized people but have been contributors. And I just wish that aspect would be more talked about. So that people who, so someone can feel valuable in talking to their next door neighbor just as much as somebody who raises $1 million or speaks, you know, publicly. You know, it's, I mean, I'm thinking, I've talked a lot about our salon. John and I have been doing a salon for the last now 4 years, dealing with racism and white privilege. And someone was talking to me about what can they do? And I said, just simply speaking up. I said, learning what white privilege is about and then expressing your awareness can be something that can be valuable.